Hello, and thank you for joining me for the fourth episode in our special series of podcasts spotlighting the Arizona Institutes for Resilience and their work with individuals, businesses, and communities to manage risks associated with climate change and to discover opportunities associated with solving the climate crisis. Tumamoc is an iconic place in the Sonoran Desert. It is a place of cultural, traditional values, and is part of a story of resilience and relevance. Tumamoc takes us back to Native populations and brings the past into the present, acknowledging the contribution of those indigenous cultures. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and I thank you for joining us, and I think you'll be really glad you did. Our guest today is Ben Wilder, yet another extraordinary human being on so many levels and a true champion for the planet. Ben's research is broadly focused in desert ecology and botany. He utilizes multiple approaches and timescales to establish baselines to better understand modern biodiversity and to connect science to conservation. Ben has been the director of the Desert Laboratory on Tumamoc Hill since October 2016, and I can hardly believe I'm saying that because I remember when it happened, and now it's over 5 years ago. And he is also the interim director of CASMEX, and I hope I said that right, the Consortium for Arizona-Mexico Arid Environment. So Ben, you have been such a champion in the patience of getting this scheduled. And let's just tell the show guests, there were glitches in the matrix and conflicts, and you've been wonderful. What a great sport about rescheduling. So here you're finally here.
Well, thanks, Gina. I think it's going to be worth the wait. It's great to be back with you.
That's how I felt when I was preparing last night. I said, this is going to be such a great show. So for people that live outside of Tucson or the Southwest, in Ohio or New Jersey, or maybe even in Buenos Aires, that listen to our Impact Earth shows, it is, to me, a challenge to describe the magic. And that's what I call Tumamoc. There's a magic about it. It really is an iconic place. So why do not only scientists who are so enthralled with it and want to be there and study and do research, what makes it not just special, but very much on purpose and relevant? What is the magic of Tumamoc?
Well, I think it really starts with geography. And in so many ways, it is the heart of our region and our city. And that really connects, again, to the geography of the landscape. So you have the Santa Cruz River at the eastern base of Tumamoc, this 800-foot volcanic mountain. It's called Tumamoc Hill. It's a bit of a misnomer, especially for those that walk up its slopes. That's one steep hill. So it we have the it's really at the space where people have been interacting with the landscape for thousands of years, and it's all because of water. And then in addition is the vantage point that the top of the hill and this landscape provides across the whole Basin and Range province. And so at the foot of Tumamoc Hill in the floodplains of the Santa Cruz River, there we did just recent work that pushed back the oldest corn grains to over 5,000 years now. So we have evidence of agriculture in the Tucson Valley, archaeological evidence going back 5,000 years. And that is the kind of the timeline of the human use of this space where I'm talking to you from here at the Desert Laboratory on Tumamoc Hill, really it coincides directly with that. And so I think it's important to start understanding at that far back in time, because that's when people's interaction with this space started. And it continues to this day where there's a natural gravitation to this space. And it becomes for exercise, it is for connection to the space, it is to kind of work off a bad day, but then that connection builds. And I think that's where the magic that you mentioned starts getting into, and just it's beautifully subversive in a way that you start, I think people start forming a connection with a space, irrespective of maybe knowing the history. But it's just has a lot of gravity and magnetism to it. Again, just I think a lot of it's the geography. But then on top of that geography is is where culture interacts, and that's what makes a cultural landscape. And it served that role for this region at large as long as people have been in this area.
And when you talk about the work there, and I agree with everything you said. I mean, you're a great storyteller, and I'm thinking about what it's like to be there. And for people that don't know, it's a huge, steep, very arduous climbing hill to get to the top. And how many people do it every day? It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
I was just checking our most recent data. We have a people counter to help us know how many people are walking every day.
Right.
And so we're recording this in June. It's about 115 degrees out. And a week ago, when it was well into the hundreds, we had 1,500 people walk the hill one day. And we're averaging about 1,000 people right now.
Press pause, everybody, yeah. Because I have two friends that do it religiously. They go there at 5 a.m. every morning. I am not one of those people. So let's move on here. But in the term, I don't know if this question, it's coming from a non-scientist. So in terms of its resilience and the relevance of Tumamoc in the face of global warming right now, even as opposed to when I started 14 years ago, is its relevance even more important because of the extreme weather, and it survives and it thrives? So how does it relate to all of that conversation about resilience and global warming? It informs you, correct?
So yes, I think we're getting into the multiple layers that are represented in this space. So the reason we can start to talk about science here on the space is that starting in 1903, the entire Tumamoco area was established as ecological reserve and study area by the Carnegie Institution. And so we have 115 years plus now of long-term continuous data of tracking the pulses and dynamics of the desert. It's the best studied track of desert area in the world. And it really helped define our understanding of the function and ecology of deserts and interactions, and really established the discipline of ecology. So there's this baseline of kind of of functioning and interactions, and this over the long term, right? Not just looking at 5-year span, but looking at 115 years of data. And so that's a really critical piece of this. And in that, I think it's very important to understand that that is within this cultural setting, and those two pieces have not always been congruent, and there's been a lot of erasure on the cultural piece, and we're working currently to combine the three core elements and pillars that I see of the culture, the science, and the community. And no point in the history of Tumamoc Hill and the Desert Laboratory of those three pieces synergistically work together, and that's where we're going in the future. And that, to me, then digs into the topic of resilience, which is a really strong word and important word for our time right now. And it's also a word that can mean a lot of different things in terms of how it's used. And so how I really think about it, and maybe we can dig into this more, is learning from the plants, the animals, and people of how to adapt to an arid environment and all of its extremes, including the extreme heat waves and drought that we're currently in over close to 18 months with almost no rain and incredible heat waves during that time. But also the resiliency, right? The adaptation, the capacity of life to withstand those extreme conditions. And then I think what you're asking, how important is that time right now, where our research comes in, is where are the thresholds, where are the tipping points, where does the system potentially break down, or where do you exceed the capacity of certain species to handle that, and or cultures, and or our built environment around, and trying to identify and be a bit predictive and proactive in understanding all of that.
It matters so much. It's really strange for me doing interviews this year, post-pandemic, and in a place where, like you said, we haven't had rain. We had like 16 drops, I think, one day this, you know, a couple of weeks ago. I counted them, 16 drops. I'm barely kidding. I mean, we are starving for moisture. But what Tumamac, so it heightens to me, it puts a laser sharp focus on the importance of your work and the survival that we're going to be talking about. And Tumamac, whether you're a spiritual person or not, you go there and it does take you back to native populations and you can close your eyes and try to wonder. It brings us the past and you take it into the present, acknowledging the contribution of those native populations. Can you just talk about that a little bit and what that means, like an example or two about what are you learning and what's the value of learning from the past that we so need to learn from right now?
Well, I mean, it's fundamental to the goals that I have as director of the lab, and we're just at the beginning, and it's a long process. And so I guess I want to start with where we're hoping to get to by where we are now, which is a lot of atonement, honestly, and of listening and being present and building relationships and trust and friendships. There, you know, as I described at the outset of this space being a cultural landscape. So first off, you know, Tumamac, the meaning is an Otom word that's derived from Chumamac, which means a horned lizard or a Chumamagiduag. So this is the hill of the horned lizard. And so that hardening of the T happened through the last 200 years, and so that's where our name originates from, just as Tucson was Chuxon, base of Black Mountain. And actually, that Black Mountain is Chumamac. And so the words we use to describe our region originate from this cultural landscape where I'm talking to you from. So that recognition, and then the recognition that the last 115 years, which coincide directly with when the Desert Laboratory has been here, has been a great period of separation of those two realities. There's been, unfortunately, the way it happened is that science kind of pushed out a lot of that cultural knowledge. And I find it sad and a bit fascinating in the sense that much of it is overtly sad. But it's interesting in that from our long-term studies of the saguaro, I think we're just maybe starting to understand how the Otom saw and understood the saguaros in that long-term generational perspective. And so where we're going is trying to reconnect and reconcile different ways of understanding the world around us. And I think that's what's so powerful about Tumamac Hill is that there are so many layers here, and there's so many ways that different people and different cultures have experienced the world around them and have experienced the world around them and will in the future. And so there's just so many different lenses that you can put on. And that's really, to me, what transdisciplinary research is in an academic setting, which is kind of bringing together multiple viewpoints, multiple lenses, multiple ways of seeing the world, and having either be they individuals or researchers in a professional setting, essentially putting on blinders of how I'm a botanist, right, and a biogeographer, and I'm going to put on blinders in terms of how I'm looking at the landscape and looking at the plants and their diversity, and I want to see how someone, maybe an architect or a cultural knowledge bearer who is focusing on saguaro collecting and of the fruits that is pertinent at this time right now, as the saguaros are totally in fruit, and understand the landscape how they see it, and then kind of merge those perspectives. And that is all the challenges we face right now require bringing together all these ways of knowing the world to sum our collective energies and approaches to address the great threats and challenges that we have, because they're not just climate driven, they're also socially driven. So we can understand to talk the same languages, that's going to also help us move beyond. So Let me ping it back to you, but there is one particular project that I think exemplifies what I'm talking about that we can get into.
So I would love to, every once in a while I do this, and I don't do it all the time, but I would invite our listeners to press pause here for a minute, and you're listening on a device, and I would invite you, which I'm going to do, to rewind and to absorb what Ben Wilder just said about the importance of all of the work that's going on what is really a very little hill. It's a very small geographical space, and its value, its importance to our world, not just to Tucson and the 1,500 people that walk there every day, but for what you're learning and sharing. So I hope everybody will do that, because there's definitely a spiritual message there and a scientific message and all of those things. And then I want to go off topic just for a second, and it's not really. When you talk about adaptation, tell us what's happening with the saguaros. It's been on the news. There have been lots of blogs written about it, because nature is adapting far better than humans, and the saguaros are magnificent and very different than the 45 years I've lived here. So can you tell us what's happening and why? I get to ask a scientist.
So, yeah, I think I've been saying, you know, it's a time for us to be attentive and to try to listen and observe to what the saguaros are telling us. And I mean that very much in a scientific way.
Right.
In addition to everything else. And so maybe just kind of a timeline here. Last summer, a year ago, June, we had it was a fairly wet spring, and then a fairly dry and windy June, but a fairly average flowering and fruiting set of the saguaros. And then the non-soon of 2020.
And then nothing. Did you say the non-soon?
Yes.
Love it. Hashtag non-soon. Okay, I'm going to take it.
Yeah, let's hope that's a thing of the past.
Right.
By August, it wasn't August 20th. It was June 111th. And what I mean by that is the June is our arid foresummer, when it's just extremely hot. The sun just bakes the land. That's what actually creates a low pressure system that then pulls in the moisture. But that moisture never really arrived. And so the conditions of last August were such that they tricked the saguaros into putting out flower buds again, just after they'd done so in June. And many of those buds aborted. So the growing stems at the top of the saguaros essentially were putting all this energy where it's where the spines come out of. It's also where the flowers and fruits come out. They're called aerials in cactus. And that they got very stressed. Okay. So then fast forward through the rest of 2020 and into 2021, almost no rain. And we then saw in May of this year a really strong and a lot of flowering on the saguaros, and then also a lot of flowers emerging off the stems, the lower stems of the saguaros. So for people not familiar with the saguaros, normally the flowers and fruits are clustered at the tips where the new growth is. But we were seeing a lot of sidearm flowering, which is abnormal. And there's a lot of speculation of what's going on there. My personal thought is that several other saguaro experts kind of came to the same conclusion, that the growing tips, there was one, almost no growth in the last year and a half of the saguaros. And then the new growing tips at the top were extremely stressed by last summer. And so they kind of reawakened the older aerials or growing tips lower down on the stems and then used those to produce the flowers. Interestingly, the in a really, really dry year, we saw a higher set of flowers and currently a higher set of fruits. We thought a lot of the fruits may become aborted, including along the side stems, but that's not what we're seeing. The majority of them are reaching maturity and setting millions and millions of seed will be met with a really strong summer monsoon. That's the whole adaptive life history of the saguaro, is putting out the seeds and flowering at the driest time of the year, and then to then get the seeds in place for the monsoon rains, which allows them to germinate. I think that, and this is not this is a hypothesis, but I think it's quite likely that the stronger flower set and accordingly fruit set in a really dry year is actually because when they do flower in the middle of June, there you can picture them as a little oasis in the middle of a very stricken desert. There's yes. not much else
stark.
Flowering.
Stark is a good word.
Oh man, it's intense this year. And so, but for the insects, the especially the bees and the wasps, the doves, woodpeckers, anyway, that is the watering hole, right? The nectar in those flowers. And so I think if the saguaros over a long period of evolutionary time, I think they have been rewarded by putting more energy in what is a stressful year, but because they're the only show in town in terms of resources, they're getting a higher visitation rate and likely higher pollination and kind of fertilization rate of their flowers and then creating more fruits. And so I think that's why we see a higher level of flowering and fruiting in drier years.
So Ben, now I know why we had scheduling difficulties, and I'm barely kidding because I am thrilled that I got to ask a scientist that knows his stuff why it's happening. I mean, all of my friends and I were all talking about it because they're beautiful. The flowers, this sounds ridiculous. They're so beautiful, they almost look fake. And you shouldn't say that. Fake flowers are supposed to imitate nature, but they are beautiful. And if you're listening in Ohio or Michigan, Google saguaros and see what's happening because there's been a lot of news. So Ben, thank you for that. And it's basically when we talk about, you know, preserve the planet. And I try not to say that anymore. The planet's going to be fine. It will right itself. It's us that has to be worried. So here's the saguaro taking care of all of its natural inhabitants. And I'm just thrilled that you told me that story. It will be retold.
Well, it's a great example too, because within the press in response to this, there was a lot of concern about. I think the headline of the Daily Star was. Saguaros send SOS with flowers. And it's like, well, not necessarily. And that's what I mean where we need to be attentive, because I think there is a stress response happening. But these are very long-lived plants. Over 200 years.
They're not at
150
risk.
Years.
Right.
I mean, so for 115 years of science here at the lab, we still do not have enough data that even spans one individual's full lifespan if it was established before the lab was built. So it's a very long-term approach to life in the desert, which is critical. But I think it's also important that we are seeing unprecedented heat waves. We are seeing with the unprecedented combinations of drought and heat. So for many, if not all of these saguaros, they may have not seen conditions like this. And so I think that's where the attentiveness and the attention and our monitoring and listening and watching not just saguaros, but the birds that going to them to see how they're responding and to try to understand what. And that's why data sets such as at Tuma Makeo, as well as Saguaro National Park and Oregon Pipe National Monument, these long-term data that helps us really identify variances from the average to be able to predict, to get a sense of, okay, where are these tipping points perhaps, and where does concern need to be perhaps addressed?
It is fascinating to me. Thank you. And my family will love it too, because we've been obsessed with talking about it and stopping the car and taking pictures. And to me, your point is so great about it's not an SOS for the saguaros. It's an SOS for the citizens of the planet that are helping contribute to this extreme heat, even still as we speak.
What a great opportunity for community science, right? We can all partake in this.
Yes. Yes, it's wonderful, and the timing is so perfect. And there's so many more things I want to ask you, but before we go into, I want to know what your vision is and what's going to be happening with you at AIR. But what role does art play at Tumamoc? Because when I've visited, it's very obvious there is some integration of arts and culture there. So can you just, what are your thoughts on that? Do you agree with me?
Oh, yeah, no, thanks for asking that question. It's an area we're just really ramping up and pushing into. And I guess it goes back to that transdisciplinary approach or working with multiple perspectives to kind of tell these stories, communicate what we're seeing, but actually undertake that process of understanding and interpreting and discovery. And so really, to me, for the with the arts and science are very much cut from the same cloth. And what I mean by that is that I think what triggers the creativity and inspiration for an artist is the same thing that does that for a scientist, which is our observations, our curiosity, our what intrigues us about what we're observing. And I think a scientist may take that and form hypotheses and just set up experiments and go in that direction. And an artist may think about ways to capture that or study that over time or maybe take elements of that into a larger work they're thinking of. But we're talking about the same thing. And so rather than going in off in two separate directions, I think there's a huge space for arts and science to be synergistic and to work from the outset of co-creating either projects or, the arts can inform the science and the science can inform the arts, and that going down that process of creation and discovery together. So then it results in many things. I think you both understand the subject way better than you would otherwise, because the scientist is bringing in approaches to document that they may have not thought of, and vice versa with the artist. But then on the goals of actually making the work relevant, I think artists bring something to the table that scientists, by and large, are pretty crappy at, which is telling the information in a way that people can understand it. And that's what art's all about. But so I had a wonderful collaboration with Ben Johnson we've continued to do several, but an art science collaboration. And there's this great, there's this creative tension that evolves from having such different approaches coming together. And in my science, I really try to like have a create a tight package, right? Like I try to tell a story. It's like, this is the questions, this is what we observed, this is how we did it, and this is what the results say, and this is what you should probably think about this given the data we presented. And Ben pushed back with what we were doing, and he said, I kind of want people to be able to make their own story. I want to put the evidence in front of them, but they bring, the viewers bringing their life and their perspectives to it, and I want to create the space for them to then tell their own narrative, inspired by what we have, and that's just a really fundamentally different approach, and I love that way of thinking. So,
And you have to tell us who Ben Johnson is, because not everybody knows him, and I am a little familiar with his work, but he's extraordinary. That's probably why I've heard of him. So tell us who Ben Johnson is.
yeah, Benjamin Johnson is a fine art painter based here in Tucson. But his work is kind of photorealistic in with oil paints. But it really, I think, to me, well, above many of his talents, he creates portals. And you stand in front of his work and you are transported to the point in time or the concept that he's creating there, because his work is so hyper realistic. You're able to relate to it in a way, but that you would with a photograph, but it's so much deeper than a photograph. And enmeshed to that is a kind of a collapsing of time, that is kind of that portal, infinite point or infinity point, that he brings you into. And it's really stunning work.
It looks like photographs. I mean, it does. It's so breathtaking and amazing. And I'm glad that you brought him up. And you know what? He would be a great show guest to kind of
Absolutely.
play off a lot of the things that you've said. So before we go into your
Well, let me just add one thing, Gina, really quick. So
Sure.
how we're coalescing all of this here at the Desert Lab is, so we've created the Tuamotu Institute for Art, Science, and Culture, which is led by Roseanne Hansen. And that is a space where it's our umbrella that we're essentially having the creating the space within the long-term ecological research station, for this mixing of perspectives of art and all of our outreach within the community, but then creating that portal for artists to come in. And so that's kind of the forum that we're really going to be expanding and building off of all these possibilities.
So to me, that just speaks volumes about how very intentional it is in terms of the integration. It's not just going to be, you know, oh, there's art. There's a very mindful integration of arts, and that's of such value, even from a multiple intelligences point of view. People learn differently, and it contributes to the richness of that experience. So it just reminds me that it's been way too long since I've come up there, and I'm like, okay, Gina, maybe in September.
We're going to be ready for you.
I know. So I want to ask you about another project, kind of go off topic for a minute, but it's all part of your work, before we go into what's in the crystal ball and what is your vision for working as it relates to being a part of the Arizona Institutes for Resilience. So tell us about your involvement with Baja Geogenomics.
Okay, fun.
Did I say it right?
You sure did. Yeah, okay. Cool. So this is good. Yeah, we're good. We're hitting the whole spectrum of approaches that we're using to kind of better understand the desert. So this project really falls in line with some of the early work here at the Desert Lab, which was, what is this region that is the desert, right? I mean, the Sonoran Desert that we live in didn't have that name. That name actually came to be from Forrest Shreve, previous director of the Desert Lab, who established the boundary and the identity of the Sonoran Desert as a region of biological unity that surrounds the Gulf of California, so including the Baja California Peninsula, the upper Gulf of California, southern Arizona, and much of Sonora. And it's intimately connected to the Gulf of California. And so a lot has been understood since that was about 1930 and formally published in 1951. So we've learned a lot since then. But there's still some fundamental questions that remain. And they really boil down to, what were the forces, the mechanisms over millions of years, or more recently on the scale of hundreds of thousands of years, that have led to the evolution of life that we see today, the modern biodiversity you were talking about when you gave my great introduction. And so this is especially at play on the Baja California Peninsula, which is one of these wonderful model systems at the global level, where we can understand the processes that went into play of creating the peninsula. And so what I'm talking about here is geological processes that we have really strong dating for. And so it's a little bit of a story, actually. So the biologists have been identifying along the peninsula with the use of genetics over the last 15, 20 years. So doing studies on birds, plants, insects, reptiles, mammals, and they're showing what's been given a particular name of a species. So just the pack rat or the sweet pitaya, the sour pitaya, two different types of cactus, king snakes, rattlesnakes. I could go on and on. There's over 60 or 70 taxa now that have been shown this, that what's been given one name, when you look at the genetics, there's actually discrete populations and what we call evolutionary significant units. So clustering of populations below the species level. So it's also been termed cryptic vicariance, which is kind of a jargony term, but essentially meaning if you're just looking at the species morphologically, you may not recognize that actually genetically there's a lot of different things happening. And the biologists kind of invoked that there was a separation at the middle part of the peninsula, that where all these species seem to genetically break. And they invoked that there was a seaway that must have been several millions of years ago between the Pacific Ocean and that crossed into the Gulf of California. And that was that vicariance, or that separation that limited the species. But the geologists were saying, okay, biologists, people, that sounds great, but there's no evidence of that. Like, you keep talking about this seaway, but we don't have any proof of that.
Yeah.
And honestly, the whole field was just kind of stuck with the biologist saying, well, it had to be something. The geologist saying, well, it probably wasn't that. And so myself and many collaborators, I'm giving you the long-winded story here, but I think it's exciting.
No, but it's so fascinating to me because it says to me it's all connected. It's all connected. So keep going.
Absolutely. And so the myself and collaborators got together at this first in 2012 at the first Next Generation Sonora Desert Researchers Summit. Or NGEN. And this is a group of collaborators across disciplines and across the borders of the Sonoran Desert that are kind of come together every several years for these large summits. And then we do lots of other events in the meantime to really bridge the gaps of disciplines and borders. And so at this first summit, we had a session that was called the 4D Evolution of the Gulf of California, where a lot of these questions I just described were put together. And we said, wow, we should really put together a study and a proposal that gets at that. And lo and behold, after 6 years of trying, we got our Moonshot NSF proposal funded. And so we're actually undertaking the work now. So this was a dream that we're actually able to do now, which is starting from scratch and looking at three independent hypotheses that link the geological mechanisms that could drive this at three different scales in time. So the Mid-Peninsular Seaways 3 million years ago, climate changes through the Pleistocene, so everything kind of on the hundreds of thousands year time scale, to actually a rainfall asynchrony that you get in the peninsula. So along this latitude, this is one of the things that makes the peninsula such a great model system, is you have you cross 10 degrees of latitude. So from Ensenada or San Diego in the north, all the way to the Tropic of Cancer in the very south there, Cabo San Lucas. In the north, it's almost all winter-derived rain coming from the Pacific. In the south, it's all summer-derived rain. And so you get a six-month offset of when the rainy season is. And it's entirely possible that when the reproductive functionings are just when the species are actually active, that is creating the genetic distinctions between the populations in the north and south. So we're starting from scratch, looking at these three hypotheses, but it's intimately linking the geological questions and approaches with the genomic approaches. So we're testing those hypotheses with full-scale genomes of six different taxa that have their ranges up and down the peninsula. And those genomes we're doing at population level. So we're taking about 20 different populations through the peninsula and doing the full-scale genomics. This is essentially what that means is more data than we will hardly even be able to know what to do with. I mean, it's like the human genome, but for all these different species. And the technology revolution of genetics is just so powerful in terms of what it can tell us. So again, it's this transdisciplinary approach where the geologists, we meet frequently over the last year and a half, where the geologists are telling us how they're testing things and dating it, and then we're working with on the biology side of informing, using that to inform our models, and then our genomic analysis are informing where the geologists need to look, and that's geogenomics. So it's this reciprocal understanding of the landscape on evolutionary timescales to really hone in at the speciation boundary. Where is the tipping point of where divergence leads to speciation, and using the tools of geology, which is incredible in dating, and genomics, which is incredible in resolution of differences, and merging those to be synthetically more powerful in understanding how life evolved.
So I want to say thank you as the person on the street, non-scientist, for once again explaining even the name Baja Geogenomics. It's not self-informing for me.
No.
And so thank you for making that science real and important and relevant. So I just think it's pretty magical. And we talked a little bit off air about, we're both on the board for SATO International, which is dedicated totally to research in the Baja area. And, you know, I'm a hanger-on. I haven't been active. There have been, you know, waxing and waning times where I've been able to participate, but I don't want to give it up because I'm so proud of the work they're doing there and how it informs everything for the rest of the world. So hopefully we'll see each other at a board meeting someday. I'm sure they'd be really happy.
The studies of deserts and oceans, that's what their focus is. That's what it's all about.
And it's the first time, it was a long time ago, probably 6 years ago, that I heard about the vaquita, the little tiny beautiful porpoise, which I have yet to see. I'm still hopeful if there are any left, but that's a conversation for another day. So let's kind of move on for a bit about, it's very exciting what happened at the university from where I sit, having been a partner of theirs. I'm an alum. I am a really proud Wildcat. And something happened there that doesn't happen at a lot of institutions, and it doesn't happen easily. A lot of institutes were put under one umbrella with our friends Jim Beiser and Kathy Jacobs and many others to form Arizona Institutes for Resilience at the University of Arizona. And I am so impressed with every guest that I've interviewed, with talking to Jim and Kathy a lot about what's going on. So I want to know from you, has it changed anything in the way that you show up in the world or your work? How has it impacted you and your vision or your strategic plan for the Desert Laboratory? Or has it?
It's been a really awesome turn of events for us at the Desert Lab. And it's kind of fun. So we come in to air as the new kid on the block a little bit. So not to go too deep into this at all, but bureaucratically, the Desert Lab was within the College of Science since it became part of the university from the late 1950s. And AIR sits under the vice president for research under the president's office. So it's outside of any colleges. It's under the office of the president and led by the Research, Innovation, and Impact and Betsy Cantwell, who's a fantastic leader, who's been with the university for about 2 years now, and her chief of staff, John O'Neill.
I know, visionary is what
We're
I have to
very
say
lucky
about her.
To
yes,
have them.
We are very lucky.
And I mean, your leaders are really, their merit is shown in challenging times, and we couldn't have had anybody better at the helm, in addition to Jim Beiser, this last year and a half as we navigated the pandemic. It was actually a period of growth for us. And so essentially, so the Desert Lab is now part of AIR, right? So we are, that's what I mean, the new kids on the block. So coming in from a new system, and it's a really exciting time. So the AIR has, and I think you touched on this in previous episodes of this series, but AIR is kind of the continuation of the center that started the ISPE, the Institute for the Study of Planet Earth, and then Institute of the Environment, and now there's an Institutes for Resilience that the cohesively, and I think the changes have been reflective of the times, and where we are now is a renewed effort of bringing all the might that and real insightful approaches and just honestly powerhouse of teams and researchers across the university focused on the environment, looking forward, addressing climate change, but in a way that you have solutions that actually better society. And that's where the resilience piece comes in. And it's this new era of linking all of those across campus. And so independently of the formation of AIR, we undertook a strategic planning exercise, pretty lean and mean, not a bloated effort, but really just kind of, okay, where are we focusing for the Desert Lab? And it became very clear that our power is in the role of doubling down on the original mission of the lab, which is understanding how life adapts to aridity and understanding the future of life in the desert, but bringing in what I mentioned earlier, these three pillars of science, culture, and community, and having them all firing on the same cylinder. And all of this is connected to resilience, right? The future of life in the desert is how you can adapt and be resilient and learning from, as we talked about earlier, all of these different perspectives that tell us to do so. When I read the strategic plan for AIR, I was like, oh my God, our strategic plan couldn't align any better if we had tried. I mean, and they were done in isolation. So it was this like, okay, there's no like getting to know each other period of like, are we talking the same language? It was, we're already talking the same language and going the same direction. Let's just start running. And that's what's been happening. So we're, I think, the real power of air, and we're just getting the wind back in our sails after, you know, launching a new mega institute at the outset of a pandemic is not necessarily how you draw it up, but it's happening. And we're able to start to coalesce the what can be often siloed or disparate efforts on a mega tier one research university and bringing those powers together and those efforts together in a synergistic way that's not redundant, but saying, okay, how can we sum these parts and really start to move the needle in ways that we're not necessarily doing, but we have all the pieces of the puzzle and we just need to link them better. And there's so many examples of that. Water, energy, climate forecasting, and one that I'm really excited about is air and land food resilience. But we could keep listing it, and it's just, I just think it brings the potential of all the amazing work that's happening across the university and just sets us up for not just success, but actually making an impact and having solutions for society.
You know, this is so out of the, it's like so wacky that I'm going to bring this up, but I often wonder where goosebumps come from. And I've said to people many times, you can't fake goosebumps. You can't like say, well, I wish I would have some goosebumps right now. But when you talk about it, I'm covered with them because your passion, the excitement, what it means to the planet, our community. And I feel the same way every time I talk to Jim Beiser. When he was first putting the plan together with Kathy and some other people there at what was the Institute of the Environment, and I was so excited. And the dream has not only come true, but it's bigger than any, it's the absolute perfect example of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And there's so much silo work still happening when it comes to conservation and climate change. And that's what Jim wanted to stop. Integration, 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 work in the community. The university should be out there and we should have students out there. And it should be all part of an integrated vision for our city and our community and our planet. So you are a part of that. And I'm sure you just make it stronger. And I say that from my heart. It's very exciting to talk about it with you. And, you know, little did I know you were an expert on saguaro blooms, but why am I not surprised? I think you were interviewed by like MSN or something. I'm not sure, because you know. And I'm really glad I remembered to ask you. So now there's some like just ask Ben questions that I have. So get ready, right, my friend.
Okay. Okay.
As a scientist, as someone who I know cares deeply about our community and our planet, what keeps you up nights, or are you up nights, when it comes to climate change and this really oppressive drought is keeping me up nights because of my empathy, and it's not empathy, it's sympathy for homeless people and at-risk populations that don't have cooling or cold water. We don't have enough cooling centers. But you're a scientist and you're a wonderful human being. How are we doing as a planet moving in the right direction? I want to know what your thoughts are. I want to get inside Ben Wilder's brain about how are we doing?
You know, I think when I think about it on those terms at that global scale, that's what keeps me up at night.
Yes. But
when I think about the examples and the people I just love and respect and I'm just awed by, and the work I see happening on the ground, then I can go to sleep with a smile on my face and know, you know, this isn't going to be easy, but we have some incredible people and collaborations and just desire to learn and do better happening all around us. So yeah, I really embed myself in the what can we do and
yes,
then do it.
Yes.
And the practical elements of it.
The solution pieces.
Absolutely. And the getting our hands dirty and doing it, not just talking about it. But specifically, I think one of the major threats and just areas that give me great concern for our region, for the deserts regions of the world, really, but especially the greater Southwest, is that synergistic element of drought and heating and extreme heat. That is a, and then wind, honestly. It's getting windier here, and that is one of the most intense drying agents for plants and animals. So there's some really nasty elements coming together that are just kind of baking our landscape. And subsequently, when what's really shocked me to action this last year is the role of fire in driving change. I didn't quite expect that, honestly, in terms of how, I mean, just what we saw in the fires in Australia at the very beginning of 2020, the fires throughout the arid Southwest last summer, the fires in California and Oregon and Washington, and the fires we're seeing again now through a totally parched year here in southern Arizona and central Arizona. So the role of fire as change is massive. And I think in our region, we need to understand that better. And so we're working with a lot of collaborators on doing so. So yeah, that's kind of where my mind's been, especially this last week as we wake up to these Tatooine-like sunrises of haze due to the fires raging around us.
All over the place. And my son-in-law is in fire management, and it does not spark joy in my heart because I love him, but he's committed, and he's in a program internship to learn more and more about fire management. And you're so right. When I think about it, I haven't mentioned this in a long time, but 10 years ago, our cabin in Greer burned. And that fire, the Wallow Fire, was 865,000 acres.
Yeah.
We used to talk about mega fires being 50,000 acres. Now they just consider that like a baby fire. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's anything else you want me to ask you. I have some closing comments, but I want to make sure that all of what you wanted to share about your work, the importance of Tumamoc Hill, I have some thoughtful closing remarks, if you will, because I was so looking forward to this show, and I have so much respect for you and your family and all that you mean to me. So is there anything else that you wish Gina had asked you, but she forgot?
No, I mean, I just can't wait till we get to do this again and dig into it all over. But, you know, I would just say that,
yay,
you know, I think that, you know, on talking about the kind of the structural changes that were that were made at the U of A. And so now that we have AIR, we have the leadership of Jim, we have the leadership of Betsy Cantwell and John O'Neill and many others, that we're just scratching the surface. We're just getting started. I mean, when I think about the Desert Lab and the role that we can have in making our science relevant to the 1,000+ people that walk the hill a day, it's like, oh, we haven't even gotten started yet.
Yes.
And so it's really exciting, and we're entering into a new era here. We're revving it up. We've got an incredible team behind me, Anna Saifuli Valencia and Clark Redden, and then about 20 other incredible people. So I look forward to checking back in with you, hopefully before long.
No question about it. I'm having lunch with Jim next week, and believe me, we'll be talking about it. And part of my comments, it's like, I don't feel like I work for a living, and I mean that sincerely. I was at a lunch the other day with people from the city of Tucson and Goodwill, and we were at Flora, a local restaurant, and, you know, an hour and a half goes by, and I said, is this work? Are we really doing work? And it's just wonderful, and it's because of the experiences like this. But I was Googling, of course, doing some research, and when you were appointed, I found this incredible way to describe Tumamoc. And it was the article in the Daily Star, and it said, what does it take to run one of the most anthropologically, ecologically, gastronomically, and culturally important places in Tucson and beyond? That captures Tumamoc. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
said, just ask Ben Wilder, the new director. And then also in the article, to just repeat what you said, the area surrounding Tumamoc Hill is the longest continuously inhabited site in the United States with evidence of maize cultivation for over 4,000 years. And I'll tell you what, we better be paying attention to maize cultivation because we're in for quite a ride. So my final words are from my heart. They always are. The world needs more Ben Wilders. That is, I'm just putting my pin in it, and I'm putting my stake in the ground and saying that, and I don't say it lightly. He's passionate, dedicated. The efforts of all his work incorporate diverse perspectives. He strives to create opportunities for collaboration. That's what you're all about, Ben. I talk about you like you're not here, but that's okay. Across borders and disciplines, and a more holistic understanding and appreciation for this amazing thing we call the Sonoran Desert. He is everything that's right about the world, if you ask me. And it's been an honor and a pleasure getting to know him and spending more time with him today, learning more about him and the important work he's doing on our behalf. So thanks, Ben. And you know me, I say it from my heart, and it's always so much fun and informative and just a really wonderful experience to spend time with you.
Oh, you're so kind, Gina. The honor really is mine. No, well, thank you.
It's
such
wonderful.
A joy to be with you.
So we'll be back. Let's just say that we'll be back. And I want to, I usually thank our listeners because without them, there would be no us. And then I'm trying to do better at thanking the amazing team that I have, which you reminded me of, because you know, Kelly King, our show producer, makes the magic work, and we have people behind the scenes that make everything beautiful. And then we have Dave, the magic maker when it comes to editing. Dave Labreck is our sound engineer, and it's a job that I will never have, that I would hate, and that I can't even stand thinking about it because it's so much work. So thanks to everyone, and just if you are anywhere in the desert Southwest, don't leave the house without water. If you're blessed enough to have air conditioning in your car, it doesn't matter. Just be safe, because I'm worried a lot about these temperatures that are going to literally, you know, cause us to lose some lives here in Tucson. So thanks, Ben. Stay safe, and you will be back, I'm sure.
Can't wait, Gina. Thank you.